Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 29th, 2010, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to be talking about a subject we'd like to turn to at least once a year, the matter of sports and media, the role sport plays in our society. And we're going to be talking to one of the leading sports writers in the country, Dave Zirin, author of a brand new book about what he would characterize as the crisis in sports today. It's a show I think you'll really enjoy. I'm looking forward to it. But before we go to our guests, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Decisions made by the Federal Communications Commission over the next few months will determine whether the public will have a say in the future of the Internet. The only thing that can match the torrent of corporate money raining down on Washington, D.C., is a huge show of public support for Internet freedom.
It was standing room only at a public forum in Minneapolis last week as FCC Commissioners Michael Copps and Minion Clyburn and Senator Al Franken took the stage. Senator Franken.
I believe that net neutrality is the First Amendment issue of our time. Unless it's freedom of religion, which until last week I thought we had kind of worked out. Today, a blog can load as fast as the Wall Street Journal, and if the blog is good, it can get more traffic than any media conglomerate. But if bigger companies can pay for faster priority internet access, that blogger no longer has a shot. And these big companies know that when they pay for access, they win.
Calling the internet an incredible technology that intersects with just about every challenge confronting the United States of America, Commissioner Copps warned that the present danger is that big business will put us on the road to the cannibalization, cableization, and the consolidation of broadband and the internet.
Now, I suppose you can't blame companies for seeking to protect their own interests, but you can blame policymakers if we let them get away with it. Deal-making between big internet players is not policy-making for the common good. Special interests are not the public interest, and stockholders are not the only stakeholders. I will not settle, you should not settle, for gatekeepers of the internet striking deals that exchange internet freedom, yours and mine, for bloated profits on their quarterly reports to Wall Street.
Commissioner Clyburn largely attributed the success of the internet to its open infrastructure. She compared the internet's democratizing effect on society to that of the printing press.
I say without hesitation that an open internet is indeed the great equalizer. It enables traditionally underrepresented groups, like minorities and women, to have an equal voice and an equal opportunity. It allows any connected individual to distribute their idea to a global network or run their business right from their very own home. Just as a printing press dramatically reduced the price of publishing and disseminating works on a large scale, the internet reduces the barriers to entry for new players.
The forum was co-hosted by Free Press, the Center for Media Justice, and Main Street Project. Dozens of people from all walks of life spoke passionately about the future of the internet.
Affirming net neutrality is critical because without it, our communities won't have the ability to tell their stories and know that they'll be heard.
I'm here to urge you to implement the Universal Broadband Plan and pass strong net neutrality rules, because if telecoms are allowed to run the Internet without regulation, they'll have the power to snuff out independent media.
Companies such as Quest, AT&T, and Verizon have received subsidies and tax breaks to build out the infrastructure, but they squandered their money by handing it over to their shareholders at the expense of their now antiquated networks.
Any sort of two-tiered internet that frames the internet as more of a mall than a town hall is completely unacceptable.
We need net neutrality for your human rights.
Please let information flow freely across the internet.
I'm glad I got a chance to talk to the FCC. I'm sorry it's the two members that probably don't need to hear the message that I want to say, but I've really been mad as hell for quite a number of years in the way that it has sold out the public interest to the commercial interests in this country, and it's got to turn around, and I appreciate your efforts to do that. But who said that the FCC's role is to maximize the profits of Verizon and Google?
Fundamentally, I think net neutrality is a question of freedom, and I want an internet that is as free as this country is. Thank you.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. We look forward to your phone calls later on in the program for comments and questions for our guest. Our guest today is someone who's been on the show a couple times before, and we look forward to having him a couple times more in the future. It's Dave Zirin, the author of the brand new book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Dave Zirin's author of many other books. He's also the host of SiriusXM Radio's weekly show, The Edge of Sports Radio, and he writes his blog, his column, The Edge of Sports, which can be seen online at edgeofsports.com. Dave Zirin, welcome to Media Matters.
Bob, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's get right into your brand new book, which just came out. And I imagine it might be harder for you to get a press pass at some of these professional sports teams' games after this book makes the rounds.
Oh, no doubt. It's real. The book takes a very harshly critical stand towards owners. And in many cities, the sports team actually owns the flagship sports radio station, like where I live in Washington, D.C. Sports Talk 980, the main sports radio station, is owned by Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington Redskins. So it creates an almost Pravda-like atmosphere when it comes to sports and sports commentary, and it has been difficult. It's been impossible to get on the flagship sports radio stations to debate these issues. I've been on other sports radio, but no, it is very, very controlled.
You know, while we're on that issue, Dave Zirin, I recall an interview several years ago when Paul Tagliabue was the commissioner of the National Football League, and Chris Berman of ESPN was interviewing him. I think it was on draft day and the commissioner was available. And there were a number of very controversial issues at that time, including the labor deal that the NFL was working on and changes dealing with the health of the players.
And yes, Berman asked him, how did you get so handsome?
You called it. And, you know, what I think, and I think in fairness to Berman, fairness might not be the right word, but to put into context, ESPN is deeply conflicted because they broadcast NFL games and they make money off of NFL games. And so as a journalistic organization, they have a strong stake in these games being popular and well watched.
I know people who work at ESPN, who write for ESPN, and they've spoken to me about there is an actual tension that exists because there is a journalistic side at ESPN and there is a business side at ESPN. And oftentimes there is an uneasy merger between the two that upsets individual reporters, but is a fact of life of the station. But honestly, I find ESPN as an entity less alarming than the fact that the NFL Network, the NBA Network, have hired some of the best newspaper sports writers to work for them. That, to me, is a much more disturbing development because you have people who are very, very good at their jobs with a ton of contacts who actually do very good reporting. But then there's that there's that reality that to the really tough issues like concussions in the NFL, like the labor agreements, like in the NBA, issues that have to do certainly with race and racism, that it reaches a limit. It reaches a border, and then the stories don't get told.
Your new book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, as soon as I heard about it, and you told me about it some time ago, I knew I was going to like it. I recall being a young boy in Cleveland, Ohio, being a fanatical baseball and football fan of the Browns and the Indians. And I was raised in a Republican household, very pro-business. But at a very early age, I said, you know, what exactly do sports team owners do? I mean, I could understand in other businesses that they did research and development. They knew what the business was about. The guy who had a butcher shop knew about meat, stuff like that. But it seemed like the owners didn't know anything really about the game. Oftentimes they were just some playboy or they inherited it. And sometimes they were fans, but they weren't necessarily competent. But I never understood what they added to the value of the franchise.
Well, even worse, in the latest generation, they have these pretensions of expertise and act as de facto general managers. And that's one of the things in the book that I write about that it just actually drives me batty. It would be like saying that because you really love the car that Magnum P.I. drove, you should run General Motors or something. I mean, there's no real causal connection there that makes even a lick of sense. But for all Bob McChesney fans out there listening, I mean, we should say, Bob, that I sort of gave you the coup de grace in the book. I gave you the last word, if you will, on the last page. And I interviewed 3,000 people for the book, Bob. I mean, obviously, none of them is actually, a few of them, I got to give some credit to some of them, with the expertise that you have in the area. But the quote you gave me was just way too juicy, way too good. It was about public ownership of teams. Loved it to death. And so, yeah, it was almost like I gave you the knockout punch on the last page.
Well, I love all the sports metaphors. Keep them coming. We don't get those very often, except for me on Media Matters. Our guest today, Dave Zirin, author of the brand-new book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, just published, just came out in the last month by Scribner's, the publisher. Dave Zirin, sports columnist, sports radio host, been covering sports for years now, writing for The Nation and a number of other publications. Online, you can find his work at edgeofsports.com. He's also the host of the radio show, Edge of Sports, every week. It's Sunday nights, is that right?
That is correct. We now broadcast live Fridays at noon.
Okay.
So Sirius 122, XM 143, and hey, I am at a landline phone. How about that?
Okay, so why don't we go to a brief musical interlude, and we'll get you back on the landline phone, and we'll pick up the conversation in about 20 seconds.
Sounds great, Bob.
Okay, thank you, Dave Zirin. Well, that was our musical interlude here in Media Matters. We haven't done many of those before, but if we can keep finding tunes like that, we'll have to start doing some more. I can start playing disc jockey. I'm Bob McChesney. Our guest today on Media Matters, who's now on a landline, is Dave Zirin, author of the new book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, just published by Scribner. Dave Zirin, I think we've got a stronger connection with you now.
Yeah, rock on. This is really good. Thanks for your patience. And, hey, you get to hear some good music in the bargain.
I'll say so. You know, Dave Zirin, invariably I've had you on the show before, and one or two people will get a hold of me and say, why on earth are you doing a show on such a ridiculous, silly issue as sports? And one answer I like to give is that I used to work at United Press International 25, 30 years ago covering sports. And by my calculation and talking to the editors there, roughly 20% of all the material they handled online at that time was sports. I mean, it's this huge part of what is considered news and media in society. So if you're doing a show on Media Matters, it's pretty hard to avoid the role sports play and sports journalism plays. But I think it goes beyond that. And what's your answer to that? Because I suspect you've heard that yourself.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And I would give two answers to that. I mean, the first thing is that it's the closest thing to a national language that we have in this country. And oftentimes it can be a tremendous gateway to actually talk about big political issues in this country, issues of race and racism, issues of sexism, issues of homophobia, issues of the power of big business to crush democracy and dissent. All of that exists in sports. And when you do it through sports, oftentimes you can have a discussion with somebody who otherwise would shut you down. And I got to tell you, the most rewarding thing about the work that I do in writing about that place where sports and politics come together is people who come up to me and say, hey, your book where you talked about Muhammad Ali, I gave it to my dad who's really conservative, and we actually had this really constructive discussion about racism and the black freedom struggle, and we never were able to have a discussion even close to like that before. So thank you. And I say, don't thank me, thank sports, because it's what really allows you to do that. Now, the second thing, though, that I would say is I would relate it to a Ralph Nader quote, who he says this a lot in speeches. Ralph Nader says, "You better turn on to politics or politics will turn on you." I'm a big believer that you better turn on to sports, even if you're not a sports fan, or sports will turn on you, because it has such a mammoth effect on our culture, on our language, on our society, and on the very question of urban economics in a very profound way. So if we just write off sports stories as, oh, that's just about sports, I think we're missing out on one of the great fleecings of America right now. And I say that as a sports fan.
In fact, the book goes, one of the really strongest parts of the book, that opens with a fairly substantial discussion of the extent to which the ownership of our major sports teams, especially football and baseball, but also basketball, have these modern gleaming, glistening arenas and stadiums across the country that are built to no small extent with public tax dollars, yet the benefits accrue entirely to these owners.
Yeah, and it's so much bigger than just, oh, they're fleecing the taxpayer. I mean, we're talking about sports stadium as becoming a substitute for anything resembling an urban policy in this country. I mean, look at the cities that one could argue have been left behind by the United States of America. Look at cities like Detroit, Milwaukee, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Oakland. What do they all have in common? The degradation of an industrial base, shuttered factories, and brand new gleaming stadiums built with public money. We're talking about $30 billion is the number that I came up with, and I think that's actually a low number because I don't incorporate tax breaks into that or land value. That's just pure tax dollars.
And those aren't the only subsidies these owners get. I mean, I imagine there's all sorts of other goodies they get along the way, too.
Oh, absolutely, from naming rights to, I mean, like in Chicago, right near you, for example, Comiskey Park was built with $191 million entirely with public money for Jerry Reinsdorf, and there's actually been also periodic $20 million refurbishing that's happened with it over the years. But in addition to that, it's of course now called, it's not the new Comiskey Park or the new Comiskey Field, as it was said it was going to be called. It's U.S. Cellular Field, and that's a $68 million naming rights deal, the entirety of which goes to Jerry Reinsdorf. And this is in a time in Chicago where you have teachers who are being laid off, of course, cuts to hospitals, drastic cuts to city infrastructure. And what's Jerry Reinsdorf's pet project, and I talk about this in the book, is he is one of the big apostles, if you will, of standardized testing and standardized testing in public schools. And so you're taking money away from schools with one hand, holding forward this incredibly flawed manner of judging the success of public education, standardized testing. And then, of course, Chicago under Arnie Duncan, one of the big charter school meccas in the United States. So you see the way it all kind of weaves together in a very uncomfortable jambalaya that sports is then basically used as a Trojan horse for.
And you go in the book through some of the cities, in addition to the ones you mentioned, and the tribulations they've had building stadiums and the quality of the industrial base of those cities. And one city that you start with that's striking, of course, is New Orleans.
Sure. I mean, I feel like you have to start with New Orleans because in a lot of ways it kind of touched all this off for me intellectually. It was just, you know, like the rest of the country, and of course we're right now on the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and like the rest of the country, just looking on with horror as first it looked like the great city of New Orleans actually avoided the hurricane, and then of course the levees broke and the horror that ensued, and that there was no emergency shelter, there was no emergency housing. What there was the Superdome. That was basically all that was left. So degraded had been the public services and public works projects in the city. And here's the Louisiana Superdome, a publicly built stadium, this luxury stadium, and it is a luxury stadium, became absolutely uninhabitable, really within hours. Within hours. And then, of course, people were loaded up on buses and sent to another dome in Houston, the Astrodome. And so it just said something about like what we have left in our cities, for goodness sakes, especially living in times of dangerous inclement weather and other national or natural catastrophes. And it's like, okay, what do we have left to show for the billions in public dollars that have been spent? We've got stadiums, and that's it.
Our guest, Dave Zirin, who you've been listening to, I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We're doing a live program this August 29th, 2010. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222. 9455 Dave Zirin, host of the Edge of Sports radio program on Sirius Radio, also the author of the weekly column, Edge of Sports. You can find that at edgeofsports.com. His work appears all over the place. If you're a sports fan, or even if you're not a sports fan, you've probably seen his byline somewhere along the way over the last several years. You go through his examples, too, that are quite striking. I follow sports closely, as you know, and I was not really aware of the details of some of this. In Minnesota, for example, talk a little bit about how they got a new baseball ballpark up there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I feel like I do want to backtrack just a second, Bob, and just say one of the reasons why this enrages me so much is that I am a sports fan, and I do love sports. And I hate the way that sports is used to push through projects and policies that I think a lot of sports fans would otherwise find objectionable, but they use sports to say, well, what are you going to do? You know, it's do you really want to lose the team?
I mean, that gets to the point, Dave, where I was going to get to in a second, but you got right at it, which is that there's sort of a loaded gun held at communities' heads, that if you don't give us our brand-new stadium, that city the next state over or over somewhere else would be glad to do it. They're desperate for a team, and you'll lose the team.
And I interviewed Mark Mariel, who's now the head of the National Urban League. He was the mayor of New Orleans, and he described to me his negotiation with George Shinn, who's the owner of the New Orleans Hornets, and about when they wanted a new stadium to stay in New Orleans, and about how he just had no leverage or negotiating power at all.
Yeah.
Like he would say, how about we do 50-50? And George Shinn was like, yeah, no. 40? No. 70-30? No. I mean, it's just, there's nowhere for a city to go unless we change the paradigm of the debate. And this is where your work and your writing, Bob, was so helpful for me in terms of thinking this stuff through for the book. It's like we have to change the terms of the debate to say, well, wait a minute. We actually have been rooting for these teams longer than you've owned these teams. If you are going to make a move to actually threaten to move it, then maybe we'll threaten you back and say we will take over the team. We will claim fair use. We will claim eminent domain. And we will take over the team, basically.
But isn't that
legally take over the team?
Isn't that crazy un-American talk? That could never happen in America, could it?
Except in Green Bay, of course. thanks for the softball. Where you have America's football team, the Green Bay Packers, one of the most lauded legendary teams on the American sports landscape. And yet I have met football writers who've read this book since it's come out, Bob, who did not know that Green Bay was owned by fans. Did not know. And I said, well, who do you think the owner was? And they just said, well, I guess I just never thought about it. It's like 112,000 people own the Green Bay Packers. They're the shareholders in the team. They're not allowed to pull a dividend on their shares. All they really get is a little piece of paper that says, I'm part owner of the Green Bay Packers. That's all they get. And it would be a very interesting model for other teams to pursue. But you asked about Minnesota.
Yeah, let's go back to Minnesota and how they basically took this, you know, fairly progressive and I think highly regarded metropolitan area where corruption is considered somewhat lower than some of the other cities you discuss. What happened there?
First of all, you're absolutely right about that. I went to college in the Twin Cities, and I think it starts by looking at the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome, the former home of the Minnesota Twins. I've been to a bunch of games there over the years. Granted, it is a dump. It always was a dump, like playing in a big hefty bag. Billy Martin once walked in there when he was manager of the Twins, and he said, God, how could Hubert Humphrey have named him after this dump? And it's very accurate. But at the same time, the owner of the Twins, you can understand why they'd want a new stadium, but the owner of the Twins was Carl Pohlad and has been for decades. Carl Pohlad is the richest owner in Major League Baseball. He died last year at the age of 92. And even though he was the richest owner in Major League Baseball, he spent the last 20 years of his life pushing to get a publicly funded stadium through the State House in Minnesota. And it was defeated in referendum after referendum, even though it was supported very strongly by the last two governors, Tim Pawlenty and Arne Carlson, both from the IR party, the Independent Republicans, as they're called there. And Pohlad pushed and pushed and pushed, and they produced commercials with little kids dying of cancer, saying, will this little boy see Marty Cordova play, a player for the Twins, before he dies? I mean, they did, and the kid had actually, it's horrible, but the kid passed away before the commercial was produced, and Pohlad went forward anyway and put it on the air. So not good people, not good stuff. But despite this incredible push of money and influence and power, the progressive people of the state of Minnesota rejected it in referendum after, I believe it's six different referendums. they rejected giving Polad money for a new stadium. So finally, he went around the referendum process, spread a couple hundred grand around the Minnesota State House to both the independent Republicans, who weren't very independent, and the Democratic Farm and Labor Party, as they're called in Minnesota, who didn't show much of an allegiance to either farmers or labor. And they pushed through this stadium project, a $300 million stadium called Target Field. Further irony, given some of the stuff going on with Target right now and the boycott against Target. But this is the real tragedy, though, and this is what I talk about in the book. And this is why, even if folks out there aren't sports fans, they should pick up the book or at least become conversant in some of these issues that we're talking about. The very week they were due to break ground on this new $300 million stadium, the Polad family, Tim Pawlenty, and all the rest of them, that was when the bridge collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was fall 2008, I believe, was when the bridge collapsed. And the bridge collapsed. It sent, 13 people to their deaths. I must have ridden over that bridge a couple hundred times, honestly. And Tim Pawlenty would brag about the fact that he would never sign into law any tax hikes that would go to improve infrastructure in the Twin Cities. He would call it like urban pork. He would never sign, and he was so proud of that. And he uses it still on the stump today about what a fiscal conservative he is. Well, he pushed through the stadium, which reaches into the pockets of every man, woman, and child in the Twin Cities to a strong degree and into the state as a whole, all to build a stadium that people rejected on six separate occasions. So that's the thing. You pay a real price when the priorities are slanted in this way, especially when our cities are, in my mind, in need of such dire repair.
What was the press coverage in the Twin Cities, to your knowledge? I know you weren't living there through this period, but from what you could determine, how effective a job did the sports media and the news media of the Twin Cities do in covering the story?
It's a terrific question, and I did try to check that out and look at it, and I would have to give it, I mean, honestly, like a D triple minus in how they did it. I mean, this is one of the advantages of having the sports page over here and the front page over there. Is, I mean, even though there was a news hook right there, because Tim Pawlenty and the Polad family, they canceled the groundbreaking out of, quote-unquote, respect for the bridge collapse. So if people had wanted to, they could have pushed and said, well, wait a minute, maybe these aren't two separate occurrences. Maybe one has everything to do with the other. But the fact is, I mean, on far too many sports pages, your sports page, the oxygen of your sports page is access. And many a sports reporter has learned that you have no First Amendment right to access when it comes to the world of sports, like maybe you could argue in the world of politics. So you find yourself shut out. Basically, almost every sports journalist is like an embedded reporter, basically. And so they had a real problem in pushing through and being able to talk about the issues in a way that's critical of the Polad. So there was definitely a ton in, like, the local city paper. There was a ton in the independent media. There were even a couple of op-eds in the main papers, the Strib, that's the Star Tribune, and the Pioneer Press. But as far as the sort of thing where the acclaimed sports columnists took this and ran with it, you just didn't see it. They preferred to grab the theme of, gosh, everyone always hated the Metrodome. Isn't it awesome that we have this new park? And this is a sad thing because I'm a big Twins fan from having lived there, and the team is doing really well this year. And as always, they're doing it with a very low payroll, very good management, and all the rest of it. And they are now succeeding, and people are saying, well, it's because of the new stadium. Aren't we glad we got the new stadium? And so then the fact that these players are playing their butts off and Gardenhire is managing his butt off, it's used as a way to further sell the stadium dreamland.
Our guest today, Dave Zirin, author of the brand-new book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, just published by Scribner's. We're going live today in WILL AM 580, so please call in if you have any questions or comments for Dave Zirin. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Let's go to line one, Champaign County.
Hi, yeah, I have my usual five things here. But it seems to me that these media types that aren't critical of this, I think they like to schmooze in those corporate skyboxes that perfectly good stadiums are torn down to, with less seating as was done in St. Louis, to give the corporate elite their skybox seats with all the the best, as it were. But actually, since it is the fifth anniversary, I wanted to mention The Big Uneasy by Harry Shearer screening across the country tomorrow. I think it's a very important thing. And it's just mainly because of the date, but also you can see what the infrastructure that ought to be being spent on is if you go to this film, and how it isn't being done, and how all this corporate largesse and sports stadiums are being spent on. But I wanted you to, if you could, say something about Pat Spillman, because I think, if you mentioned earlier how sports is used politically, if there was anything that illustrates that, is the Super Bowl after 9/11, or after the killing of Tillman, justify the next invasion, I guess it was. It seems to be that's the way it played. I'm particularly concerned because I heard that Tillman was reading Chomsky and was having arguments with his co-fighters, whatever, his inside of his platoon, and the idea that his uniform was burnt by his superiors makes me think that there was actually a great backstory here that even the new film that has come out probably doesn't get into. And I know I've gone on long and not really asked a question, but I think...
No, that's actually a very good question right there.
Yeah,
but our previous President Bush, he's a direct beneficiary of corporate cashing in on the largesse of the stadium, and I guess the Rangers are bankrupt now, if I heard correctly. I don't follow it as closely. So I'm glad you're doing it for me. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And I should add, you've got two parts there, that the book actually has a nice discussion of George W. Bush's magical career as an owner, in which his bank account expanded dramatically for a reason. Exploded.
I mean,
in a way that, you know.
He invested $300,000 in the Texas Rangers as part of a huge ownership buy. He was named basically general managing partner, which allowed him to go on TV as, quote-unquote, the owner of the Texas Rangers, which obviously in the sports-mad state of Texas is a heck of a platform. And then he cashed out, I believe, made about $15 million.
And this is all during the period he began when his father was president.
Yep, began when his father was president. He had just gone busto with his oil company, Arbusto, which is what it was called. Spanish for Bush, by the way. I don't even know why I know that and why that's important. I always found it funny that he named it. He was like King Midas in reverse. Everything he touched turned to crap. And then he got involved in sports where the game is rigged, basically. And he got public land. He got public stadium. And I got to say, much to the shame of the late Ann Richards, who was the governor at the time, who signed it over to him. And I go through it in great detail in the book, but it basically gave him the political capital, it gave him the personal capital, it gave him the prestige that made him winning the governor of Texas over Ann Richards something that was there for the taking.
You know,
and I quote Karl Rove in the book, and I quote George Bush in the book, both talking about how it was really through owning a sports team that gave him the cachet to be able to go on and do what he did.
Dave Zirin, the first part of the question dealt with Pat Tillman, the NFL football player who gave up his career in his prime, sacrificed what is clearly millions of dollars to go fight after 9/11 in Afghanistan, and spent several years fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, to be killed in, I believe, 2003 or 2004. And it's come out, as the caller pointed out, that Pat Tillman was indeed very much an American hero, an extraordinary figure, but almost entirely different from the way he is presented in the dominant view. Talk a little bit about the Tillman story.
Yeah, absolutely, and I've been reporting on it since when he left over there, when he left to fight and join the Army Rangers, and when he died. And I've interviewed his mother on several occasions, Mary Tillman, and I do want to say something about that. First of all, I've seen the new film, The Tillman Story, and I interviewed the director on my radio show. His name is Amir Bar-Lev. And just to be clear, the film is brilliant, particularly people out there who are media critics and questions about how the media tells stories. I learned a ton from looking at the documentary, because the documentary does take the time to go through. I mean, it's actually a major theme in the film. Like, the media construction of Pat Tillman and how different it was than the real Pat Tillman. And Amir, the director, he was able to gain the participation of the Tillman family in there. They're a very reticent family when it comes to things like this. And the reason why they participated was precisely because they're just so repulsed by the way the media presented Pat as kind of like this G.I. Joe figure. And when the reality of Pat Tillman was the guy who would, I mean, he read Chomsky, absolutely, that's true. He also read the Book of Mormon, even though he was an atheist. I mean, he was really somebody who took reading seriously, took learning seriously. He was a very much a free spirit, and he joined the military after 9/11, and then he started to turn against the war. And one of the things that started to turn him against it was a role he played doing support, basically, like perimeter support, when the bogus rescuing of Private Jessica Lynch. And you know what that's all about, Bob, right?
Yeah, though that was the media event, basically. They created a bogus event to make it look like some Sands of Iwo Jima event.
Yeah, that Jessica Lynch was being tortured by her captors, and there was this daring rescue, and the reality was that she wasn't being tortured and that she was given up voluntarily. And they changed it to create this image of this hero of Jessica Lynch and a hero of the military saving this poor woman. And Pat Tillman saw the gap between what he saw in person and what he saw on the news, and he said to friends, "This is effing BS." And Pat and his family, they do like to swear, so as you see in the film. So he didn't say effing BS. But you get the point, though. And I think Pat Tillman, and the movie goes through this as well, the documentary, and my writing on it as well, I got to say, I talk about this a lot, is the way that sports uses Pat Tillman, the way the NFL uses Pat Tillman. There's a statue of him where the Cardinals play. After he died, George W. Bush addressed the fans on the big Jumbotron with Pat's family standing there. And it was all used to construct this image of Pat, to use Pat in death the way he never wanted to be used in life. He never did an interview when he was in the Army Rangers, despite repeated efforts by the military to get him to be basically a recruitment ad. And he wouldn't do it. But in death, they were able to use him a great deal. For political means, for political symbolism, and that's just one of the many things that drove the family bananas. And another thing that I know upsets Mary very much, Pat's mom, is the way that the NFL, they opened up the Pat Tillman USO Center in Bagram, Afghanistan, and so they're very happy to use Pat's name, yet they've used none of their ample political influence, and yes, the NFL owners have ample political influence on Capitol Hill. They've used none of that to try to actually get at the truth of the circumstances around Pat's death, which the Tillmans have been ferociously fighting for years.
And just so for listeners who might not be familiar with the Tillman story, and I think there are probably many who would fit that description, Pat Tillman was murdered, killed in the war, and initially it was reported that he was in some heroic fight going after Afghani Taliban terrorist types or soldiers, and it came out later that the government knew all along he'd been killed by friendly fire, and they'd repressed this so they could use Pat Tillman in this sort of propaganda role. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. And there are a lot of differing opinions even in the Tillman family about the friendly fire death. Mary believes very strongly that it was really just a question of almost like overheated machismo of soldiers. Like, they just really wanted to shoot at something, and they were frustrated that they hadn't. And all this is in the reports. And there are other people who do feel like your caller did, even a little more conspiratorial about it, especially because there was a lot that was kind of ugly that happened right afterwards. Like, they immediately burned his uniform. They burned his combat journal right there on site. That's indisputed that they did that.
Well, that certainly does breed
attribute that to panic.
Yeah, that doesn't breed confidence in the integrity of the process by any stretch of the imagination. Our guest is Dave Zirin. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. Dave Zirin's the author of the brand new book, Bad Sports: How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, just out by Scribner's. This is one of those books that is, if you're interested in sports, I guarantee you'll fly right through it. If you're not interested in sports, it's still a great read. And part of the book, Dave Zirin, you go through how owners are, I won't know if increasingly is the correct word, but are actively, in many cases, using their sort of monopoly franchises and towns to propagate their religious and political views in a way that really is inappropriate, in your view, and inappropriate especially when they're oftentimes doing it in these publicly funded stadiums. And what's also striking about it is that it seems like You know, it's not like there are socialist and vegetarian and Buddhist donors. It seems like they all come pretty much from the same place politically.
That's absolutely true. I mean, there are some minor exceptions, but even those are a little odd. Like, you've got Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, who on the one hand is like an acolyte of Ayn Rand, but on the other hand, he's underwritten some remarkable documentaries, like the Enron movie, mm-hmm. The Smartest Guys in the Room. He did a movie where he got a lot of crap for it by the Freepers and the Newsbusters types. That was about trying to understand the mindset of a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
And he also is the producer of the good film Good Night and Good Luck.
Yeah.
The Clooney film about Edward R. Murrow and mm-hmm. resisting McCarthyism, of course, put out in the context of Cheney and the Patriot Act. That's Mark Cuban. That's a lone exception, and it says something if I'm turning to Mark Cuban. It says how low the bar is.
That's right.
If I'm talking about what it means to be a progressive owner, the bar is low. Most owners are much more like Dick DeVos, the owner of the Orlando Magic.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about Mr. DeVos.
Oh, proudly, happily. And there's a whole story here that will involve me at the end, so I hope I get to all of it. But Dick DeVos, founder of Amway, billionaire several times over, he is somebody who owns the Orlando Magic. He's getting a $480 million publicly funded stadium. He's also a supporter, first of all, of the Republican Party. I mean, he gave the largest donations in the country to the Bush reelection campaign in 2004 and the largest individual donation in the history of politics in 1994 when Gingrich was gearing up the Republican Revolution. But that's not even as disturbing as the kind of groups he gives money to. Focus on the Family Research Council, especially organizations that were founded by the John Birch Society. I mean, he really does make Rush Limbaugh look like Chomsky, some of the groups he supports. And this $480 million stadium, like, I don't care that his politics are right-wing. I could give a hoot. The problem is that this is high-end money laundering. I mean, this is about public money going into his pocket and then being used to underwrite this right-wing shadowy edge of the Republican Party. I mean, this is why these groups exist, because of people like Dick DeVos. Now, Dick DeVos also has a son named Dick Jr. who married a woman named Betsy Prince. And this is like a feudal marriage, because Betsy Prince's father is Edgar Prince, who's a billionaire from Michigan, and he and Dick DeVos Sr. have been friends for decades, and they were the founders of various John Birch offshoots together. And Edgar Prince, of course, his daughter is Betsy Prince. She married into the DeVos family. His son is Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater.
Mm.
And so you get these connections where Eric Prince got, of course, $700 million in government contracts for Blackwater during the Bush years when Republicans controlled the Congress, while Dick DeVos is underwriting that very Congress using public money. This doesn't take a conspiracy theorist just to see that this is basically how politics works.
And then another,
the United States and sports being used to do it is what drives me batty.
And then you talk about a baseball team, to go from basketball to baseball, the Colorado Rockies, who is the owner has sort of made it team policy to encourage, you know,
the God Squad.
Players with quote unquote values, meaning people who share his particular religious views, it sounds like.
Yeah, values and religious values. I mean, it translates to mean evangelical Christianity, and particularly accepting a right-wing edge of evangelical Christianity. And then they do Faith Night at the Park in Colorado, which is a very common occurrence. The group that does that is called Third Coast Sports. They're connected with Tony Dobson and those folks in the Family Research Council and Focus on the Family. And so you go to the stadium, and there are booths that are, you know, high cheese, frankly. You can buy your Jesus bobblehead dolls and bobbleheads of all the apostles. But then you also have the booth where you can learn how to do gay reparative therapy for your kids. So all of this mixed up in baseball at a publicly funded stadium, no less, called Coors Field, no less, which I guess is the holiest of all the beers. This is what you get when you go to Colorado, and this is what Charlie Montfort hath wrought. And players have talked about it, about if you're not down with the team prayer, then somehow you don't get on the field, or they're catching other players going through your locker to see if you have a Playboy in there or something.
I don't know what the makeup of Major League Baseball is, but wouldn't that backfire and have a crummy team if you play anything but your best possible players you can get your hands on?
Yeah, I mean, Colorado, they've been up and down these last 5 years. I mean, they had a miracle run to the World Series where they got smoked a few years ago. And they also, they made the playoffs last year. So they've done okay with this, which is a little scary. But the one heartening thing I take, and I end the chapter with this, is that they had a manager named Clint Hurdle who was big on the God Squad stuff. And Clint Hurdle, it seemed like a way that he was able to keep his job despite several horrible seasons. And Clint Hurdle, they finally fired him last year and replaced him with the much more chill Jim Tracy. And they made the playoffs after Tracy became the manager about halfway through the year. And Tracy even won Manager of the Year. Their turnaround was so huge. And several of the players set off the record. Like, man, we needed that. And it just gives you this idea that the locker room, it's not so much that they're all evangelical Christians, but that it's coercive. And this idea that you go along to get along, just to get on the field. And that's ugly to me. It's ugly because it's a publicly funded stadium, and I don't think there should be any religious stuff in any kind of public sphere. I think we're guaranteed in this country not just separation of church and state, but separation of church from state. But then it's also that baseball has this pretension of being the great national unifier and this thing that brings people together across ethnic lines, across racial lines. And this is obviously something very divisive when you call something Faith Night, but it's only open to evangelical Christians.
Now, one thing a lot of listeners might not recall, because it only was in the news briefly, was that a few years ago, Rush Limbaugh was part of a team that was attempting to purchase an NFL team, I believe the St. Louis Rams, and he would have been a minority owner, I would assume. I don't know how much bank he's got, but I don't know if he's got billions. And it got shot down, and that's an interesting story.
Yeah, and I talk about it in the book because it says something about the politics of owners. Owners, on the whole, are very right-wing. Owners, on the whole, spend their money very freely to make sure that right-wing organizations and right-wing newspapers and right-wing magazines stay afloat, even though financially they're unsupported and unsupportable. But they like doing their work in the shadows. They like being behind the scenes. They like being the guy behind the guy behind the guy. They think someone like Rush Limbaugh is a big, gauche, gassy clown. And when Rush Limbaugh, with all of his politics right out there on his sleeve, stepped in to become a part owner of the St. Louis Rams, I mean, it was very interesting to me that even though owners share Rush's politics, they did not stand up for him. Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, did not stand up for him. And that was actually, it's interesting because I go through the chronology of the story. And once players got wind that owners like Jim Irsay of the Indianapolis Colts and Goodell literally were chucking Rush under the bus and saying, yeah, we don't think he's good for the image of the league, you had several players step forward and say, yeah, I wouldn't play for him. I wouldn't play for that guy. Hell no, I wouldn't play for him. And I find this, like, really delicious, to be frank, because I know that Rush is also a huge sports fan. And, you know, George Brett was at his wedding. He used to be an announcer for the Kansas City Royals. And he also is somebody who's written about how his love of sports was only matched, unfortunately, by his inability to play them and getting picked on as a little kid and whatnot. And that's terrible and everything. But the guy's made hundreds of millions of dollars by bashing people who don't have the forum to bash back. And the fact that he was then denied his place as at the top of the sports pyramid, basically by his brethren, by the very people who support him financially, effectively, or support his ideas financially. Honestly, the Germans got a word for that, and I'm not going to pronounce it well, but what is it, Schadenfreude?
It sounds close as I could guess.
Yeah, but you get the point, though. Like, it felt, you know, it's kind of like, dude, you know, at least for a moment at least, I can feel happy that there is such a thing called karma.
Well, I should point out, too, in the book you discuss this, it's not just that Rush Limbaugh is, just sort of a loudmouth or whatever some people might think of him. He has had a number of comments specifically about the National Football League,
right,
on race in the NFL that were, in extraordinarily poor taste.
Right. I mean, like saying that watching an NFL game is like watching a comment between the Bloods and the Crips. Or saying, most famously saying that Donovan McNabb, who's a future Hall of Fame quarterback, gets a free pass from the media because of their social concern to see a successful black quarterback. But the one that I thought particularly was a problem for the NFL was when he said that he thinks that the NAACP does riot practice, where they have their members burn liquor stores and steal liquor and steal money.
Mm-hmm.
The NFL has a historic, decades-long partnership with the NAACP. And you could make a very strong case that that's window dressing, that it's PR and all the rest of it. But at the same time, you can't have that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can't have that. And so I just found the whole way it went down to be very interesting and be a very interesting window in politics of the NFL. But I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about also during this discussion what's going on in Arizona with the movement to move the 2011 All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's interesting too, because one of the things, you had five people in Minnesota get arrested a couple of weeks ago for being part of a march of 100 that was marching behind the Major League Baseball owners as they were leaving their meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the owner of the Arizona Diamondbacks, this guy Ken Kendrick, who's one of the big rainmakers of the Republican Party, and he holds fundraisers for SB 1070, that's the anti-immigration law. They're politicians who support SB 1070. He has fundraisers for them in the owner's box at the publicly funded field where the Arizona Diamondbacks play. And so this movement has been very fascinating for me, and even though my readers object to this, I keep covering it and keep talking about it. They're like, dude, get on to something else. But I find it so fascinating because it is kind of dragging a lot of these guys out of the shadows and making them be accountable for their decisions. And that I think, is only something we should welcome.
Our guest, Dave Zirin. We have time for one final caller. Dave Zirin, of course, author of the brand-new book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Let's go to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I would like to go back to a topic you were talking about a few minutes ago, and that is the involvement of religion, in quotes, in professional sports. And I see the roots of that coming about in high school or even earlier. I happen to be the parent of a high schooler right now, and I see a lot of pressure for people to join organizations like Fellowship of Christian Athletes. I see a lot of accolades made to people because they've joined, parents because they're active in this, and quite frankly, it puts a lot of us in a very uncomfortable situation, especially those of us who feel that faith-based programs don't have a place in the public schools, and also those of us who happen not to subscribe to Christianity as a religion at all. So anyway, that's my comment, but that really lays the seeds for a lot of what you're talking about later on. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you very much. Dave, any further comments you want to add on that topic?
I mean, honestly, Bob, can you let me know what he said?
Oh, I'm sorry. He was just basically saying that there's pressure on religion and sports from his experience going into college and then to high school and youth sports, and he has a child who's in high school, I gather, plays sports, and pressure on these kids to join the Fellowship of Christian
sure.
Athletes and other stuff like that, and that if someone might not be a Christian or might not be that brand of Christian, this is somewhat of an oppressive feature.
Oh, absolutely, and there's a very good book by a former NFL player named Anthony Pryor called The Slave Side of Sunday, which talks in great, serious, harsh, critical detail about the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and the organization Athletes in Action and how they get in the locker rooms and enforce a both religious and political dogma on players. And, of course, the irony of that is the athletes are told often to just shut up and play. There are coaches like Mike Shanahan of the Washington team that has a list of rules, and one of them is that bringing politics into the locker room only divides the team. And yet these so-called religious organizations are allowed to do it through the back church door. It kind of reminds me, I live in D.C. We had the big Beck rally yesterday of however many thousands of people coming out to hear Glenn Beck, and it kind of blows my mind, Bob, that the media theme today is about how it wasn't a political rally. It was a religious rally, and they're actually giving Beck kudos for that. And yet, how is it not political? Just because they keep talking about God, I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like, I said, it was incredibly
yeah.
political, and it's just they're choosing to say something that's just not true, and it's just it boggles the mind.
Dave Zirin and I, we got about 4 or 5 minutes left, and a couple of things I definitely want to get to before the show closes. You know, in this campaign to have community ownership or local nonprofit ownership of pro sports franchises, or just in generally what you call the fans' bill of rights, getting stuff through to make sports accountable to the people who, you know, support it, put the money forward. Where do players fit in? I mean, you talk at times about players who are very supportive, but at the same time, you know, many players, all of them get what I would consider fairly good incomes at the professional level.
Mm-hmm. Of
some of them get extraordinary incomes. And are they, I mean, it seems like they have a stake in the status quo too, at least an immediate material stake, don't they?
No, I think that's actually very true. They but at the same time, it's a tough question because at the same time, the only reason they have the salaries they have is because they fought through them. And it's so distorted and weird, Bob. I'm not saying this as an endorsement, but the only time we get real labor reporting in the country in the mainstream press seems to be when it's sports unions. And we're about to have an avalanche of it over the next year. Because
don't
we
have three major leagues will all have deals come up next year?
Oh, I think they're going to be lockouts at least in the NFL and the NBA as well. And this is an opportunity for people who see themselves as progressives or see themselves as pro-labor to actually try to explain how the owners are not just screwing players, but how they're actually messing with our cities and messing with fans and all the rest of it, even though it is very easy and very tempting, and I say tempting from a personal perspective, to write it off as billionaires versus millionaires. It just does, but it doesn't work that way in practice.
Well, let me give you an idea, sort of issue that concerns me, and I know we've spoken about this before, which is I used to attend lots of professional sporting events. I don't attend very many more recently, and especially basketball, which is a game I have a passion for. I can't attend games anymore because there's so much commercialism and junk that goes on, except when the actual game's being played, your senses are being overloaded with commercialism and noise. And,
yeah.
You know, how to change that, the players reap some of the benefits of all that commercialism. How do you get them on your side?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the only way that's really going to change is for fans to develop an independent voice. Now, you know, Bob, I've been part on the board of a group. I'm not paid a cent for doing it, of a group called the Sports Fan Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And I like what they're doing. I feel like they're moving in the right direction. They just hired a really good executive director named Brian Frederick. People can check out the website, sportsfancoalition.org. And I think what you're saying raises the issue of why we need as fans to be organized independently of players, because the interests don't always necessarily go together. And as a sports fan, we have a stake in less commercialism, not just because it's annoying, like you're saying, Bob, but also because it means the games are longer.
Mm-hmm.
It means they end later. It's that much more difficult to get your kid hooked on sports. And some people might be listening and saying, well, that's a good thing. I don't want my kids hooked on sports. But I got to tell you, I'm a believer that sports is like a hammer, and you could use a hammer to bash somebody over the head, or you could use a hammer to build a house. And I want my kids to be into sports, but in a positive way.
On that note, Dave Zirin, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Understood.
Dave Zirin, author of the brand new book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, called the best sports writer in the country by the New York Times' Robert Lipside. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters.
My privilege, Bob. Thank you.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for working the board, Melissa Trentz for being my producer. I'll be back with you all, another live show, 167 hours. Have a great week, everyone.